Can you hear me well with the back? Yeah. So I was realizing yesterday that I wish I had chosen a topic that had a bit more to do with cosmology. So I thought I'd say a few words at the beginning, some provocative statements about cosmology. If you think that the quantum state is a state of incomplete knowledge, then it's perhaps inappropriate to ask what is the quantum state of the universe. Because implicit in that question is the notion that quantum states are physical states, and therefore the universe needs to have a physical state, so it ought to have a quantum state. But if quantum states are just states of knowledge about an underlying space of physical states, maybe hidden variables or something like that, then the only appropriate question is, what's the physical state of the universe? And you might say, well, our knowledge of the universe is represented by some quantum state.
Are you taking that as a fact or as a proposition? That is true.
Okay.
I'm just wondering what your assertion exactly is.
I'd like to endorse a research program wherein one takes that point of view on quantum states.
All right.
So to make a segue into this talk, there are many good reasons for thinking that quantum states are states of incomplete knowledge. But there's some serious obstacles to making that research program work. And to my mind, the biggest obstacles are the phenomena of non-locality and the phenomena of contextuality. So, to some extent, I study contextuality because I want to advance this research program. I want to understand how quantum states could be states of incomplete knowledge. And so, although I know that non-contextual hidden variable models of quantum theory are impossible, I study them to understand the phenomena better and maybe to realize how to go beyond such hidden variables. Okay, so that's the spirit of this talk. I'm going to be telling you about non-contextual hidden variable models. You can't have them from quantum theory, but we need to understand a little bit better how they work. I should mention that often it's easier to understand something when you have some use in mind. So if there's some technological application, often that drives you to understand it better. So in recent years, we've seen a lot of nice applications of non-locality. We heard about them in the talk this morning, randomness generation, secure key distribution, and so forth. And something I've been working on are technological applications of contextuality, of violations, the fact that you can't have a non-contextual invariant model. And so to really understand how you can have these technological applications, you need a very robust notion of the phenomena. You need, for example, to be able to say which experiments have surprising outcomes, which experiments cannot be explained by a non-contextual invariant model. So you need that kind of notion, and part of this talk is going to be working towards that kind of notion. Okay, so I'm going to start by reminding you of the traditional notion of a non-contextual hidden variable model is. And it's just this, that really there are these hidden states, and every basis of vectors which define the possible outcomes of a measurement actually are assigned truth values by that hidden state. So for example, here, this basis, psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, is assigned truth values, say 1, 1, 0, 0 here. And now the idea of a non-contextual model is that a vector is assigned the same value regardless of the basis that it's considered part of. So here's a basis in a three-dimensional Hilbert space. Here's another one, which differs in its choice of these two vectors in the plane, but is the same for psi 1. And so the idea is that if were you to do this measurement, if the hidden state says you'll get outcome psi 1, then the hidden state will say that you also get outcome psi 1 for this measurement. And so this is called the difference in context, and you say that the value assignment does not depend on the context. Similarly, if this guy gets the value 0, and one of these two gets value 1, then it has to be the same in the other basis. Another way of saying that, which will be convenient for me, is that every projector is assigned a value 0, 1 by the hidden state lambda. So if I have two sets of projectors which have an element in common, then the value I assign to that projector should be the same, the value assigned by the hidden state. So famously, John Bell and independently Ernst Becker and Simon Cochin proved that such a hidden variable model of quantum theory can't be had for Hilbert spaces of dimension 3 or greater. Now, If we want to make a connection with measurements, we have to bear in mind that projective measurements are idealizations. Every measurement we do in the lab has some noise, and the way you can model that, theoretically, is with positive operator value measures rather than projective value measures. So if we want to really be able to talk about experimental demonstrations of contextuality, we'd better know how to write down a non-contextual model for POVMs. And that's what this talk is about. So because there are a few cosmologists here, I thought I would say a little bit about what POVMs are. So Lathan, this is for you. So the traditional notion of a measurement is that we have a set of projectors, they're positive operators, they sum to the identity operator, and each one of them is associated with an outcome. The probability of an outcome is given by the Born rule, and they're orthogonal. So a positive operator value measure is similar. It's a set of operators, each of which is positive, sum to identity. The Born rule looks exactly the same. The only difference is that these aren't required to be orthogonal, which means that they don't need to be projectors. They're just positive operators. So let me give you an example of where you would need to use a POVM, or why projective value measures are not sufficient. So suppose you've prepared a system in a state row S, and instead of just measuring it directly with a projector value measure, what you do is you prepare another system, which I'll call little a, in some state tau a, and you couple row and tau together, and then you do a measurement on the pair. So that measurement is now associated with a projector value measure on the Hilbert space for the pair. I can put all of this into a box and say that's some effective measurement. You know, it's a big black box. At the end of the day, it's going to output some outcome, and my formalism should be able to represent that measurement. So how ought I to represent it? Well, the probability for getting outcome k is just rho s tensor tau a times the projector k traced over s and a. And I can move the trace over a onto the inside. So here's trace over a tau a times this projector onto s and a. And this whole thing is an operator on the Hilbert space of the system alone. And you can see that it's a positive operator pretty easily. And you can also show that if I summed over k, I would get identity. So it's in fact satisfies the definition on the last slide of being a POVM. So that's a bit of a crash course on POVMs. Another thing to note is that every positive operator value measure can be implemented in this kind of way, by coupling your system to another system, which we call an ancilla, and implementing some projective measurement on the pair. Okay. Here's an example. I won't go through the details. But just to make things a bit more definite, if I have a two-level system prepared in this kind of quantum state, cos theta over 2 is 0, cosine theta over 2 is 1, and I measure in the Bell basis these four entangled states, then the effective POVM is a set of four positive operators of this form. So if I draw the blocks here, they're the 1/2 times the projectors onto these four points. So you can think of that as a way of sort of measuring, you know, roughly where you are on the plane of the blocks here. Good. Now, we want to generalize the notion of a non-contextual congruent model from projective measurements to POVMs in order to be able to model real measurements, which typically involve some sort of coupling to the environment, and therefore are not truly projective. So there is a proposal out there in the literature, which is quite popular, for how to do this, and I'm going to tell you a bit about that. So here is a paper by Paul Bush from 2003, and he has a nice generalization of the Gleason theorem to two dimensions, and then he takes that new theorem and he makes an assumption of non-contextuality for POVMs, derives a contradiction. And the assumption he makes is that there should be a function over the positive operators, which takes values 0 or 1 for every positive operator. These are elements of the POVM. So it's just like the traditional notion, you assign zeros and ones in a context-independent way, so a given positive operator just receives one value regardless of what other positive operators it's measured together with, and that's it. So I'm going to argue against this sort of proposal. Let me mention that it also appears in then. Since then, same idea that a non-potential hidden variable theory must assign the answer yes to one and only one element of the POVM. And it assigns in a way that's to a particular effect independently of the POVM it appears in. Okay, so that's the proposal that's out there. I haven't given you all the references, but it's sort of become kind of popular. And I want to say that it's the wrong approach. And this talk is mostly about trying to convince you of that. So let me give you an alternative proposal for how to generalize it. And at the same time, this is a proposal for how to generalize the notion of non-contextuality from quantum theory, from a notion that's applicable to hidden variable models of quantum theory, to a notion that's applicable to hidden variable models of any theory. So any operational theory which, you know, PR boxes or what have you, makes some operational predictions, this notion of non-contextuality will apply to it. And that's important because if ultimately you want to do the sort of thing that we do with Bell inequality violations, you know, do an experiment and say, right, given the results of this experiment, we know that theory space, in theory space, we must be here in these theories as opposed to in these other theories. Even if quantum mechanics turns out to be false tomorrow, we know that the theory that's going to replace it is over here. So it's nice to have an operational notion of non-contextuality, because then when we do our experiments, we can come up with the same conclusions. Quantum theory could be proven wrong, but we'll still know that the whatever theory replaces it does not admit of a non-contextual model, and so has a particular conceptual structure. Good. So let me tell you first what an operational theory is, because that's going to be important for the definition. So an operational theory is a minimalist statistical type of theory. The primitives of description are preparation procedures and measurement procedures. So when I write things like P and M, what that's meant to represent is a long recipe, a list of instructions of things to do in the laboratory. Okay, and that's the currency of these sorts of theories. And what the theory gives for you is an algorithm for calculating the probabilities of outcomes of a measurement given a specification of a preparation procedure and a measurement procedure. And that's all it does. So it doesn't tell you anything about what kinds of systems might pass between these devices, what sorts of properties those systems might have. Any of that realist talk is not included in this kind of theory. That's the sense in which it's minimalist. It's also the sense in which it's interpretationally not very satisfying. But it's a very useful framework to use to try to get rid of all your preconceptions about the nature of reality and any baggage you might have. You know, Einstein and Heisenberg used that trick to good effect. So if in quantum mechanics, for example, if we want to understand it as an operational theory, we just need to note that every preparation procedure is represented by a density operator. Every measurement, as I said earlier, is represented by a positive operator value measure. Some of them are protective value measures, but the most general one is this sort. And the rule is just a Bohr rule. But there are other theories, PR boxes. You can set down a general framework for such theories if you want. Okay, what's a hidden variable model? Usually I would say ontological model, as we heard in some of the other talks. But again, I thought to try to limit the amount of new terminology I need to introduce if there's people who are not expert in the audience. So. That's why I'm not using my preferred terminology. So the idea here is that we're going to now think of a preparation procedure as actually spitting out a system that does have some properties. And then we say, okay, we have to write down a physical state space. So I'm going to represent it as a one-dimensional space here. Every possible physical state is denoted by lambda. And our interpretation is that when I know that some list of instructions has been done in the lab, denoted by P, then I know something about the physical state of the system that comes out of the box. I might know exactly what it is, so a delta function, but more generally, I just know that it's some distribution. So it's basically like saying the physical state of the system has been sampled by from some particular distribution associated with that preparation procedure. And of course, it should be normalized. Similarly, a measurement is represented in such a model as revealing something about the properties of the system that you feed into the measurement device. And so, for instance, the measurement could tell you everything there is to know about that, the physical state of the system. But more generally, it might only tell you limited information about the physical state. It might carve up the state space into distinct regions, and different outcomes tell you that it's in one region or another. You can have something even more general than that, which is the following sort of situation, wherein for some physical state, some values of lambda, the outcome might not be determined. The outcome of the measurement might still be probabilistic. So what I'm drawing here are what I'll call the response functions for the measurement. So this is just the probability of getting outcome one in the measurement, given that the physical state of the system you fed into it was lambda. And we see that for all these values of lambda, you definitely get the first outcome. But over here, you have some probability of getting the second outcome as well. Over here, you have probabilities of the second and third outcome, and so on. This is the most general way of representing a measurement, so we'll allow it. And then, in order to be a proper model of quantum theory, or any operational theory, you'd better reproduce the probabilities in that theory. So this is, I'm really going through the generalization of what Joel said for quantum mechanics. So the idea here is that you want to take the probability of outcome k given physical state lambda times the probability that the physical state was lambda given that you prepared preparation p, integrated over lambda, and that should just give you the probability of outcome k that you observed. Okay, so far what I've defined as a hidden variable model, there's no obstacles to coming up with such a model for quantum theory. I haven't imposed enough constraints to actually get a contradiction or a no-go theorem. So now I'm going to start adding constraints to these models, and you'll see that you can't have models of quantum theory that are like that. So this is my proposal for a generalized notion of non-contextuality, and the spirit of it is that a hidden variable model is non-contextual if when two experimental procedures are operationally equivalent, meaning at the level of what you observe in the lab, you can't tell them apart, then they should receive equivalent representations in the underlying hidden variable model. So let me be more explicit about that. So suppose you have a whole battery of possible preparation procedures in your theory, and a whole battery of possible measurement procedures. And what you start doing is you take one pair of measurement procedures, like say M1 and M2, and for each one, you put it in front of all the preparation procedures, and you calculate the statistics for each one. So you put it all down in your book. And then you take the next one, and you find its statistics for every preparation procedure. And then if at the end of the day, you say, measurement one and measurement two have exactly the same statistics for every preparation procedure, then I call that operational equivalence. Were I to put one of those two measurement devices in a black box, hand you the black box and say, please figure out which of the two devices I put in here, there is no experiment you could do that would allow you to answer that question. That's the sense in which they're equivalent. So I put circles around the equivalence classes, so I can split this guy up into equivalence classes. Now there are still differences that remain between those measurement devices. Let me just give you an example of a difference of equivalence class. In quantum theory, two different POVMs would correspond to two different equivalence classes. Because for two different POVMs, there's always some preparation that gives different statistics for them, and therefore I could tell them apart. So they're not going to be in the same equivalence class. So actually, you can think of POVMs as just the quantum representation of the equivalence classes of measurement procedures in our world, as far as we know. The differences that remain between measurement procedures I call differences of context. Okay, so everything that doesn't change what equivalence class you're in is a change of the context of your measurement. Let me give you an example of that. So remember from before, I considered two measurements of an orthogonal triad. Now, if I coarse grain over outcomes 2 and 3 in these two measurements, that corresponds to, I represent that by a pair of projectors, the projector onto psi 1 and the projector onto the 2D space orthogonal to psi 1. And it's the same for both of those procedures, right? So in this procedure, I measure psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, and then I throw away the information about whether it's 2 or 3. And this procedure is quite different. I set up an apparatus to measure these three guys, and then I throw away the information about that. But nonetheless, they're represented by the same projectors, and there is no preparation procedure that will be able to tell these two guys apart. I'm at 20 minutes now? Great, thanks. Let me skip that example and give you a second example. It could be that two measurement procedures are measuring the same POPM, and the way they're doing it is by coupling to another system and doing a projection on the pair. But the rho A and the pi K for this measurement procedure is different from this measurement procedure. So I have rho prime and pi prime. There's a freedom in what's called the extension of the POPM to a larger system. So for example, I could do a unitary here and the inverse unitary over here. And so that's another example of a way in which measurements can differ that you wouldn't see operationally, and therefore we call it a context. Okay, now here's the assumption of measurement non-contextuality. For all the measurements in a given equivalence class, represent them by the same set of response functions. So don't let the set of response functions depend on differences of context. Let it only depend on which equivalence class you're in. So that's a measurement non-contextual model. A measurement contextual model is one wherein the particular set of response functions would depend on where you are in the equivalence class. So it might depend on the sorts of differences I just described. Right, and so the spirit of this, the way I like to think about it, is that it's a bit like Einstein's equivalence principle. So I think Einstein used this principle to good effect. He said, if there are two scenarios, experimental scenarios, where all the observable effects are the same, then maybe you should assume an ontology that makes those scenarios the same, right? So maybe you should say that being in an elevator accelerating uniformly through free space is actually the same scenario as being in a gravitational field. Ontologically, they're not different. And so it's a similar thing here. When we see no difference in the lab, let's assume that it's because what's going on at the realist level is exactly the same. It's a priori a plausible idea, I would say. So let's compare now this notion to the traditional notion. So remember, there's the traditional notion. Vectors have to receive the same values despite their context. And so if I draw this as the response functions, it means for every lambda, I can assign zeros for these guys and one for this guy. And it means that the response function for outcome one in these two measurements should be exactly the same. And the rest could be carved up differently. But that's equivalent to saying that if I coarse-grained over these two outcomes, then I should just get something flat. Now there's only two response functions. These guys are the same, then the other guys are the same. So this is more in keeping with the way I described it before. Here are two measurements that are modeled by the same projectors, and therefore they're represented equivalently. So this is how you would recast the traditional definition. But note that it's not my generalized definition doesn't give you back the traditional one, because the most general representation of a measurement involved response functions that weren't necessarily deterministic. They didn't always have values 0 and 1. So the point is that the traditional notion is my revised notion together with an extra assumption, which I call outcome determinism, meaning that when you condition on the physical state that you feed into the device, the outcome of that measurement is fixed deterministically. Okay, so the new definition I'm proposing is not simply a generalization of the traditional one, it's also a revision, right? It changes what I'm claiming that we should mean something different when we say a non-contextual model than what we meant traditionally. And in defense of that revision, let me point out that Bell successfully extracted or disentangled the notions of determinism and locality. So in early work, he defined a notion of local determinism, which said that the outcome of a measurement, he asked, does the outcome depend on space-like separated events in addition to depending on the local settings and the values and the hidden variables? And then he eliminated determinism from the definition by saying, does the probability of the outcome depend on space-like separated events, not the outcome itself? And so similarly, the traditional notion says, does the outcome depend on the measurement context? And the revised notion that I'm proposing is just asking if the probability of the outcome depends on the measurement context. So I think it's a good idea to try to separate these notions. That determinism used to be included in the notion of non-contextuality, and I'm separating them. We have a problem now, which is that we had no theorems for the traditional notion of non-contextuality. So we could derive contradictions from the traditional notion. But in the face of a contradiction now, we can't necessarily rule out this revised notion of non-contextuality. We could just give up determinism. We could say, the lesson of all those proofs is that we can't have determinism. But we can hang on to measurement on contextuality. So the question is, can we justify an assumption of outcome determinism in some way, and then show that all those old proofs are indeed proofs of the impossibility of non-contextuality? Many people have a strong intuition that if you allow outcome indeterminism, you're not really adding any generality to your invariable model beyond what you would have for an outcome deterministic model. And people who know about Fine's theorem in the context of non-locality have this sort of intuition that you get no more power to explain correlations when you add indeterminism. And so as a result, a lot of people have said to me that my revised notion of non-contextuality is not right. I should allow that POVMs could be modeled by a deterministic response function. And here's the kind of argument that people give. I think it's a good argument. It's plausible. The argument is meant to establish that for any given invariant model, you can always build one that is outcome deterministic just by moving to a larger system. Okay, so suppose I tell you that the probabilities of the outcome of the measurements are not determined by the physical state, so they're probabilistic. Well, that just means that maybe there's some other degrees of freedom in your apparatus, and if you condition on those degrees of freedom, then the outcomes become deterministic again. So this is a really bad drawing. I apologize, I don't have a tablet anymore, so I couldn't do any better. So I'm changing now to a two-dimensional state space, so lambda s, lambda a goes up. And I have a third axis which is meant to describe the probability. So these guys are supposed to be like little plateaus of probability. So it's probability 1 everywhere, but in some region of the lambda s, lambda a space. So the idea now is that instead of talking about probabilistic outcomes, I just prepare my lambda a, my new degree of freedom in the apparatus, in a uniform distribution. And then whether I get outcome 1 or outcome 2 depends on where I am in the lambda a space. And the fraction of the lambda a space corresponding to getting outcome 1 is exactly this height in the old response function. That's how it works. So that seems plausible. You should always be able to do this. Make every measurement model deterministically. Okay, so here's the argument in favor of the old, the popular proposal for how to measure KVMs. Premise 1, if two measurements have the same statistics for all preparations, then they should be represented by the same response function in the variable model. That's just what I call measurement non-contextuality. It says that equivalence at the operational level implies equivalence at the invariable level. Second premise, every measurement can be represented by an outcome deterministic response function on a larger system, as I just described. So I call those ontic extensions of your measurement. And then the conclusion is supposed to be, just combining these two things, if two measurements have the same statistics for all preparations, then they should be represented by the same outcome deterministic response function, right? So the first one tells me it's the same response function. The second one tells me that that response function can be outcome deterministic. So there I am. I have the conclusion that the popular proposal claims is the right one. So let me give you, for those who are quantum information theorists, I'll give you a little argument why you should be suspicious of this. Let me run something parallel. Premise, if two measurements have the same statistics for all preparations, then they can be represented in the quantum formalism by the same POEM. That's true. That's just quantum mechanics. Premise 2, every measurement can be represented by a projective value measure by moving to a larger system. That's also true. That's Neumark's theorem. It's what I said early on about how all POEMs can be represented by projective measures on larger spaces. So it would seem that I could conclude that if two measurements have the same statistics for all preparations, then they can be represented by the same projective value measure. But that's not true. I can have, I can set up two measurement procedures which correspond to the same POVM. But when I say, well, what's the right way of modeling them on the larger system? They correspond to doing measurements of very different projective value measures because there are many Neumark extensions for a given POVM. So I can't conclude that two measurements that are represented by the same POVM are therefore represented by the same projective value measure. So this is going to be the same sort of thing is going to go wrong with the other argument. So to see how that works, we need to talk about different partitions of an experiment. So here are a preparation on system S, system A, and a measurement on the pair. And I can partition this in two ways. I can think of this as a preparation of system S and system A, represented by this state, and a measurement on the pair. Or I can draw the line this way and say, no, I've just prepared system S, and this whole thing is an effective measurement on system S, represented by this KOVM. So let me just note that we sometimes, in quantum information, say a given measurement can be represented either by a POVM or, in the terms of the larger Hilbert space, by a projective value measure. Strictly speaking, that's not right. A given measurement is represented in one way. A given experiment can be carved up into two ways, and I can always represent this same experimental statistics by considering the overall measurement to be this, or to be this, and this guy I can represent by a projective value measure. So that slight difference is important here. Okay. Now, in a hidden variable model, how are we going to deal with this? Well, I have distributions over some hidden state space for the ancilla in the system, and I have a measurement on the pair, a response function on the pair. And I can again carve the experiment in two different ways. And so I get an effective response function when I carve it out this way, which is a function of the response function here and the distribution associated with this guy. So it can happen that I have the same sort of scenario. This could be outcome deterministic. Well, this thing is not. So now that I've introduced this distinction between S and A, I can refine that argument I showed you a few slides ago that seems plausible. So if two measurements on system S have the same statistics for all preparations on system S, then they should be represented by the same response functions on X. That's right. That's just measurement non-contextuality applied to system S. Furthermore, every measurement on system S can be represented by an outcome deterministic response function on SA, the larger system. That's also right. That was this business I showed you about always, you know, being able to represent things deterministically by expanding. So that's fine. But the purported conclusion is that if you find two measurements on S to have the same statistics for all preparations on S, then they should be represented by the same outcome deterministic response functions on some system. Now, the old proposal wasn't really clear on this, so I'm going to consider both the case that it was supposed to be on S or on SA, and I'm going to show that, you know, no matter what choice you make here, this conclusion does not follow from these premises. And then I'll be done. Sorry, I'm running a bit late. So what needs to be shown to justify the popular proposal is that if I have two measurements that are operationally the same, then they should be represented by the same response functions, and those response functions should be deterministic. This is on system S, but you can also interpret it to mean on a larger system, S and A. Okay, so that's what they need to show. The assumptions that we can justify are, one, if I have two measurements that are operationally the same, then certainly I can represent them by the same response functions, allowing that these things aren't deterministic. That's just measurement non-contextuality. And furthermore, I can always extend any response function for a single measurement to a larger space where it's deterministic. So these two things I know to be true. But they're not enough, because what I needed was the assumption of sameness on S and then deterministicness on S. That would have gotten me to the first possible conclusion. But I don't have this. I only have deterministicness on a larger system. And why do I not have this? Well, very simple argument. Suppose I do this measurement. I let the system go into a brick wall and I flip a fair coin. The POVM is just this trivial one. The way you have to represent it in variable model is just uniform distributions with probability of half each. Because it should be totally independent of what state of system you feed in here, what outcome you get. So it has to be that the outcome is probabilistic given the state. So there's no reason to assume that you have deterministic response functions on the system state space alone. The other possibility was that we model these things on the larger space deterministically. But then what I don't have is the assumption of non-contextuality. I can't go from the equivalence of the statistics on system S to the fact that they're represented in the same way on the whole Hilbert space. And the reason is that I can always have the same POVM implemented by different Neumark extensions. And I know that because pi k's here and pi prime k's here are different, they can't be represented by the same set of response functions. So that's not going to work. So there was this sort of illusion in the argument that you could get to the conclusion, but when you refine it, you see that it's not the case. So you can then ask, well, can you justify the assumption of outcome determinism in some other way? It turns out you can, from an assumption of non-contextuality for preparation procedures, which Joel talked about. But you can only do it for projective measurements, not for POVM measurements. So the conclusion is that I've proposed a way of modeling the POVMs with these indeterministic response functions. It would be nice to go do some experiments that show that despite experimental imprecision, we can nonetheless rule out some non-contextual models. Existing reports of experimental tests don't really fulfill that criteria that I've described here. They typically assume the popular proposal and show a contradiction from that. I don't think that's enough to show something surprising. And then beyond that, on the theoretical side, we have some work to do. This fact I showed you here, that we can justify outcome determinism for projective measurements, we really need to generalize that to arbitrary operational theories. So we need to have a notion of what is a sharp measurement for an arbitrary theory, and then show that those sorts of measurements must be modeled deterministically. And that's a theoretical result I don't have yet. Thanks for your attention. Same crazy story I gave just the other day when I was talking about this, but in Bell inequality experiments, single possible measurement you can imagine doing, and the experiment says, no, I didn't, right? So it says, oh, so there could have been signaling. Yes, I suppose there could have been signaling if I'd done the right measurement. Now, in that situation, we say, you know, the skeptic can be responded to adequately because the experimentalist can say, look, I don't have to do every measurement. I can just trust relativity theory. And relativity theory tells me that because these guys are space-like separated, there can be no signals. And so what we need here is a similar kind of assumption, and I have some sort of crazy ideas for how I could prove that there is a bound on how much information was signaled across time, regardless of whether somebody in the future did every possible measurement. There could be some relativistic principles. I talk about toroidal black holes with the center, which is the size of a Planck area. You know, one bit can get through, but two bits will make a bigger black hole and won't get through. You know, so those kinds of considerations from relativity could impose constraints on what can happen operationally, independent of you